Second Thought is a 100% viewer-funded operation. If you'd like to help support the channel and get some great perks while you're at it, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/secondthought. This shouldn't have happened. On July 7th, France had the second round of its legislative elections, and to everyone's surprise, after weeks of polls that projected a crushing far-right victory, the left-wing New Popular Front won. It's exciting. Now that it's been a few weeks, though, as we patiently wait for the center-left to betray the coalition and its program, we should talk about what this election actually tells us about politics in Europe. Because it's not great. With these electoral results, we're seeing fascism reach a point in many European countries, including France, where it now has enough electoral and institutional power to start moving towards a more threatening stage. Here's what I mean. For starters, the NFP won the most seats as a coalition of multiple parties. Same goes for the presidential coalition, which is made up of five parties of its own. Those coalitions usually agree with each other, especially those behind the president. But the left-wing group is very loosely aligned, with no undisputed leader holding it together and most parties regularly threatening to leave the group. There's a good chance the socialists will have already ditched the others by the time this video comes out. The NFP also didn't get that many votes. Both the left and the center-right got about 7 million votes each, while Le Pen's far-right was way ahead of both at 10 million. And that's not all. It took hundreds of candidates dropping out of the race for the left and the center-right to play nice and prevent far-right candidates from turning that huge plurality into a total sweep. This is a big difference from just 2 years ago, when the RN only got about 4 million votes. And when you look at how the party's grown since the 80s, it's clearly made big strides these last few years. And this isn't that different from what we're seeing in the rest of Europe. The elections for the EU Parliament were also this summer, and not only did the RN come out ahead there for France too, by a wide margin at around 31%, far-right parties everywhere made huge gains. In Italy, Germany, Austria, the Czech Republic, and the Netherlands, to name just a few. So, this sucks. The rise of the far-right means a much worse EU. It means more institutional power for the far right, and it also means that centrists now feel more comfortable copying their positions on things like immigration. We're seeing policies like the Migration Pact breeze through the EU, a law that's going to do a lot of the same things we have here in the US at the southern border. Immigrant adults and children are going to be detained, some for up to 6 months. Asylum seekers will have to endure much worse conditions upon entry. And nothing is going to be done to assist those who make the dangerous, often deadly trip across the Mediterranean. And just while we're on the topic, I need to remind some viewers that immigration is not a bad thing, like, in any way. This is always true, but it's particularly relevant now. Just as we were about to record this video, we started seeing this in the news.
Anti-immigration rioters attack a hotel in Rotherham.
Police officers coming under attack from a far-right mob.
In early August, all across the UK, we saw far-right lynch mobs descend on mosques and hotels housing asylum seekers, setting them on fire and doing everything they could to break in. Surging on a wave of disinformation, crowds of hundreds all over the country have gathered to attack and intimidate anyone they perceive to be a foreigner. In some cases, seemingly with the intent to kill or at least seriously injure their targets. An Asian man was pulled out of his car and watched it be absolutely destroyed. A black man was beaten by a mob of white men. And we've heard reports of Muslim girls getting spat on and getting their hijabs forcibly removed. This is terrifying and disgusting. And it's based on nothing. The whole narrative about protecting countries from immigrants that motivates both these sorts of attacks and anti-immigrant policies in general is based on nothing. Immigration is a good thing. Just as one example, here's a paper from the NBER published this year that shows that immigration increases both wages and employment for native workers at all education levels. They're not taking your job. They're also putting more money into things like Social Security than they take out. This, by the way, means immigrants are almost always living in very precarious situations. So there's that too. Immigrants also commit far fewer crimes than native-born people per capita. And all of that doesn't even touch on all the day-to-day benefits of immigrants contributing all sorts of great things to a country's culture. But anyway, back to the far right in the EU. On top of the immigration fear-mongering, more far-right members also means climate change policies getting weaker, more military spending, and cuts to healthcare. If you follow this stuff, you might have heard about Patriots for Europe. It's a new group launched this summer in the EU Parliament after the far-right gained a bunch of seats. And I know this isn't the point of the video, I want to talk about their website for a second, because this, just look at this. Their logo is three butt plugs, first of all. Let's see what else we got here. They have a child hugging a small bear, of course. Watch out for the children. Plastic bags over immigrants, that's wholesome. Why is every picture choice somehow entirely predictable and unhinged at the same time? All right, what do we have? It was sovereignty here. Okay, what's going on here? Because if I click the sovereignty arrow, it opens my email to send the, anyway, doesn't matter. Go check it out on your own time. It is truly something. This website is full of the far right's usual dog whistles. Reducing tax burdens for the middle class means cut taxes for the rich and leave the working class to rot. Preserving European culture and identity means no brown people, please. And of course, protecting Christian values and the traditional family model means, ooh, gays. And if you have any doubts that this is what they're saying, one, open your eyes. All these parties have rejected proposals to raise the minimum wage, have worked to increase violence at border crossings, and regularly stop LGBT people from gaining equal rights, whether that's marriage equality or adoption. Two, take the effect it has on stochastic terrorism. Back in June, for example, a group of far-right supporters in Paris attacked a man, called him, quote, a filthy F-slur, and said, quote, you'll see when Bardella is in power and Hitler comes back. Hey, are these guys fascist? Maybe? What is fascism? Well, that's not so easy to answer. There are tons of different definitions of fascism. There's Umberto Eco's 14 points in Fascism, Jason Stanley's 10 points in How Fascism Works, Robert Paxson's definition in The Anatomy of Fascism, and if you've followed this channel for a while, you've probably heard me use Roger Griffin's definition from The Nature of Fascism. But all these definitions are roughly similar, and they all exist because we're not going to see fascism come back looking exactly like it did under Hitler or Mussolini. You can't wait until people start throwing up Nazi salutes. That's just not gonna happen. Ignore that. Of all these definitions, I think Robert Paxton's is one of the clearest. For Paxton, fascism is distinct from other authoritarian politics because it's, one, obsessed with this idea of national decline, i.e. things are worse for our people now than they used to be. Two, it depends on a large group of people who not only believe this, but also believe that being from their nation slash country makes them better or more deserving than those who, quote, don't belong, who they think are to blame for this decline. Three, this group wants to preserve, or in their mind, bring back, their status in the hierarchy above whoever else these outsiders are. And four, they're prepared to achieve that through indiscriminate violence or both legal and extra-legal means, with or without the help of traditional elites. Everything else branches off from these core components. This all makes fascism a very flexible ideology. At its core, there's not much more to it than things used to be better. Don't ask me when or why, it just was. It's the fault of those lesser people that everything sucks now. This flexibility is why fascists often change their minds on this or that random policy, don't always agree, and aren't always expressing the same bigotry depending on their national context. When you start from this anxiety that the root of all problems comes from an outside group, it doesn't matter so much what your climate policy is, for example, unless you can use it to play up the idea that other countries are winning, or roll it up into a plot against the same anxious middle class. It's also why every fascist project has some version of a weak anti-capitalist message targeting a declining middle class. To gain power, fascists often attack very vaguely or racially defined elites, hijacking people's real concerns about inflation or welfare cuts, but pinning them on some group of bad actors instead of people just following the regular incentives of capitalism. In practice, that means that, quote, whenever fascist parties acquired power, however, they did nothing to carry out these anti-capitalist threats. Instead, quote, once in power, fascist regimes banned strikes, dissolved independent labor unions, lowered wage earners' purchasing power, and showered money on armaments industries to the immense satisfaction of employers. It's why, quote, 20 years of fascism in Italy took workers more than 30 years back, pushing wages way down and time again favoring the wealth of the top 1% at the expense of the bottom 99. So, how did we get here? in this moment where these ultra-nationalist parties are poisoning the political landscape. Neoliberalism. Around the 80s and 90s, both the so-called left and the right adopted basically the same economic program, growth at any cost. Every politician dutifully followed the same plan. Sell off government assets to private companies, cut welfare, fight unions, increase free trade, and try to make trickle-down economics work. It doesn't. Inequality skyrockets, and governments respond with mass incarceration campaigns. But that's not enough to hold this system together. You also need to sell all of these measures as various forms of freedom. The freedom to carve your own path as an entrepreneur, free from all that big government red tape, free to buy whatever kind of toothpaste you want. They'll say the free market just knows best, so the government should only be there to ensure good competitive business practices, and that's it. Of course, all of this is in theory. In reality, whatever the government does, capitalism is always going to produce monopolies and corporations stealing your freedom. Under neoliberalism, when you've gutted the public health system and sold it off, sure, you're free to choose between all these different insurance companies, but in practice, you don't feel very free when you can't actually afford any of them. This idea of making things better through this competition of everyone against everyone, in practice, really means competition between workers for jobs at ultimately very few company monopolies. It leads you down a path where, in Margaret Thatcher's own words, there's no such thing as society, just individuals trying their best to be part of the group that survives. For David Harvey, in this book, this is the sort of bedrock that fascism creeps out of. When there's no solidarity left because the unions are gone, the welfare state is sold off, and unemployment is always looming over you, ultranationalism can thrive. It responds to the chaos of capitalism by selling order. Order based on a traditional morality that's going to appeal to the chunk of people who used to be better off before this system entered its current phase. This way, ultranationalism ultimately keeps the institutions that actually drive people apart, but papers over all that with the illusion that this unjust system can keep going if you can offload the problems onto those who just don't deserve to be safe or somehow compromise this in-group's unity by being different. If someone needs to take the fall, if there really is no economic alternative since both the left and the right seem to agree that growth is going to have casualties, at least the far right is there to reassure its voters that they won't be the ones who suffer. Even though, like we've seen in every fascist regime, they absolutely do. None of this, by the way, is helped by the fact that centrist and center-right politicians have been super gung-ho about normalizing the sorts of politics we hear from the fascist right. Take Macron over the last 7 years. Not only is he personally invested in deepening the neoliberal project, cutting welfare, raising the retirement age, pushing out unions, and so on, he's been one of the earliest adopters of the far-right's talking points. In 2018, for example, Macron wanted to be the first president since World War II to honor the Nazi collaborator Philippe Pétain. He's pushed for a law against separatism targeting Muslim organizations, has echoed far-right talking points about France undergoing a de-civilization process, and referred to the country as an organic nation, a far-right idea that justifies policies like Hitler's Lebensraum. To give you an idea of how far this goes, on one occasion, his Minister of the Interior, France's top cop, actually had trouble distinguishing the presidential party's stance on immigration from the far-right's in a debate, and ended up calling her too soft on immigration. This isn't good. The reason fascism is so successful today is thanks to liberals like this. Nothing made this clearer than this election, when Macron dissolved parliament at the peak of the far-right's popularity, fully expecting to saddle France with a fascist prime minister. Years of fueling resentment with declining material conditions and normal politicians confirming at every step of the way that the nationalist logic of fascism is just as legitimate as any other form of politics has brought us here. But this isn't an automatic process. At every point, we have people making decisions and choosing to either go down this path or resist it. While we can see the terrifying gains of the far right for what they are, the preparations for a more powerful fascist movement at the helm of a major European power, we can also see in these elections the solution to the fascist problem, the solidarity of the left, both within itself and with those brutalized by decades of neoliberalism. And don't misunderstand me here. This isn't just an electoral problem. we need to be organizing outside of bourgeois politics as well. In fact, that's way more important. But that doesn't reduce the importance of slowing down fascism as much as possible on every front.
The left-far-left coalition has unexpectedly become the biggest party in the French parliament, beating the far right.
The left won, this time. Not on a program of growth, not by betraying unions, not by reforming welfare and promising to throw more people in jail. It won with a program to get rid of these last 40 years of crushing austerity. And it will again, if it can turn the tide after years of the most brutal capitalism we've seen in a century. If. Don't forget, support for the Nazis peaked at 37% in 1932. That's where we are today. What happens now is up in the air. Will we see a repeat of history where the fear of genuine socialist politics scares the ruling class into the hands of fascism? Or will a politics of radical solidarity against corporate power finally break the cycle? We'll find out soon enough. I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that this channel is entirely grassroots funded. Since sponsors don't want to touch videos like these, we have to rely on the generous support of viewers like you. If you'd like to help keep this channel afloat and get some great perks while you're at it, consider becoming a patron on Patreon. All patrons, regardless of pledge amount, get early access to every video, plus access to our patrons-only Discord server. We just made a major update to the Discord, with a revamped leveling system and monthly Discord Nitro giveaways to active members. We've also got a bunch of other cool stuff like a book club, live Q&As with me every month, and a dedicated educator role for users ready to answer any questions you have about socialism. We've built a thriving community, and we'd love for you to be part of it. So if you'd like to join the Discord, get early access to every video, and help support genuinely principled socialist content, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/secondthought. If you enjoyed this video, leave us a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out our other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.